Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today I'm welcoming back two good friends, Stephen L. Sears and Kevin J. Anderson.
Hello.
We're both
Hello, Sherry.
Okay, she's got the giggles already. She hasn't even introduced us yet.
Does.
That's too.
So Okay. Everybody understands what happened here. Kevin and I were supposed to call in 10 minutes before. We called in like 3 seconds before she went on the air.
And she was getting a little bit nervous. But
yes.
As we're famous writers, so we have to count every single second. But I think it's Sherry's show. I think we should let her introduce her show.
Yes, let the adrenaline slide away. Sherry, you're on.
Anyway, thank you both for coming. We're going to talk about several things, but they have a new novel that they wrote together called Stalag X. I mean, it's been around, but I think it's like a new version of it. Is that right?
It's a new
graphic
version
novel. I'll make the correction. Graphic novel. So it's like a big, beautiful, full-color, hardcover big comic book, but it's more sophisticated, so we call it a graphic novel.
Yes, it really is beautiful. I mean, the Vault Publishing put together this version of it, and I'm going to speak somewhat unbiased here. It looks awesome. They did such a great job of putting this thing together. It is hardback. It has a novella in the back that Kevin and I wrote about one of the characters, the art by Mike Ratera. I didn't know what to expect, to be honest. Kevin's done this before. He's an old hand at this. I'm new at this thing. And when Kevin and I went to Emerald City and we walked up to the Vault booth and it was sitting right there on the corner, prominently displayed, I picked it up and I really went, holy cow, this is awesome.
This is the first time we've ever seen it. And I'll tell you, Steve, that, yes, I've had a bunch of graphic novels published before, and they don't always look like this. So let's just leave it at that and not point out some of the other ones, but this is a big science fiction story. To boil it really down, it's like human POWs in an alien concentration camp in a future genocide war, but that's very simplistic. There's the character Joe Human is this really mysterious guy, and you don't quite know why he's in the camp or what secrets he's holding, and is he a traitor or is he a secret hero? And you've got these horrible aliens called the Krail that are trying to exterminate humanity, but they don't really understand humanity, and so they've got their own scientist who's trying to understand humans, no matter how many of them he has to take apart to figure it out. And his name is Mengele, because that's the name they give him, the human prisoners give him. And, of course, the prisoners are trying to escape, and they're trying to hold on to their own humanity. But that's just the core story. But there's the big story of the war and the corruption in the government and military-industrial complex and human colonies falling. So it's a really big story with a really core central story that's a personal story about people trying to hold on to their humanity as everything's trying to take it away.
Yeah. One of our catchphrases on this is the phrase, what is human? And the alien Krail, Mengele, that's his driving thing. He wants to understand what is human. But Kevin and I actually wrote that phrase directed toward our readership because it does go core to the question of what is human. When Joe Human is put in, and that, of course, obviously is a pseudonym he makes up to protect his identity, when he is put in with these prisoners, what is human in that condition? Humanity starts to become very porous, and at certain points it becomes a part of the currency. You know, how do you establish humanity with a creature that isn't even human? So, but as Kevin said, this is a much bigger and deeper project. Every little bit of this graphic novel has a deeper explanation, even down to the character Mengele wears a monocle, like you would expect an evil scientist to do, which looks a little absurd at the beginning, but he actually got that from killing the father of a young child who is pivotal to the story. So when Kevin and I write these stories individually and together, what you are seeing in the 160 or 190 pages of the graphic novel, he and I have probably prepared about 900 to 1,000 pages worth of material as background.
And that's only stuff in our heads.
I don't know if you guys heard my question. Did you guys get inspired by the movie with William Holden's Dalek 17?
That was definitely one of them, and Bridge on the River Kwai, The Great Escape, a lot of the World War II prison camp ones. But that's just sort of like the jumping off point, sort of the iconic part of the story. So when I say human POWs in an alien concentration camp, everybody knows what that means. But you don't just want to do Hogan's Heroes with aliens. I mean, you want to do something much deeper and much more important than that.
And every one of those movies that you just mentioned, even Heart's War, which is a more, within the last 10 years, there are common elements among all of those movies because they have a common situation and a common environment and a common stress put on the human psychology. So we reference those because there are commonalities and they're identifiable with people. The truth is the only real person who can identify 100% with all of this, at least our attempts at it, are people who have gone through it. So, we have to use movies and we have to use common references. But, yeah, those movies all have common cores that are also present in Stalag X.
That's interesting because you never know where inspiration comes from. How did you guys get started as this was the focus for your graphic novel? Where did it come from? Did one of you guys have this great idea or did a conversation?
Well, let's Scooby-Doo time phase back about 15 or 20 years.
That's how long it's
Kevin.
Yes.
Should
I make the sound effects? No, we won't do that. Steve and I have been trying to work together on something for quite a long time. And, in fact, I stayed with him in his house in the L.A. area where we brainstormed some stuff and we did some pitch sessions to – I don't even remember the networks. Steve remembers the networks. We did some pitch sessions, and I think it was just we were sitting in his kitchen just chatting about maybe some other ideas, and one or the other of us came up with the how about human prisoners of war in an alien war, and that was sort of, oh, well, let's play with that, and we brainstormed it. And this has been sort of a long journey because Steve is the TV producer, scriptwriter person, and I'm the comic writer and novel writer person. So we developed the story with the idea that we were simultaneously going to pitch it and hope to make a TV show or movie or also get it published as either a comic series. And we wrote up the proposals and we got some sample art done up and we kind of each went our own separate directions. I was trying to pitch it to comics companies and Steve was trying to pitch it to TV companies. And did we kill two different comic companies, Steve? I mean, we sold it and then that company died and then we sold it somewhere else and then the company died. But like the castle in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the third one stayed up. We had all the artwork was done. We had written the scripts. It was being produced. So we had this fully finished comic with this great story. And I'm sure your listeners can figure out that if you have a finished graphic novel in hand, it makes a much nicer package to go in and pitch to TV shows or film than it does to say, we've got a great idea and it might be published someday. So it was sort of a... One hand feeding the other hand, trying to get it finished, and now after this long journey, which has lasted much longer than World War II or any other war that we've been in, we finally got Stalag X out.
Yeah, there was a. I remember the moment that we kind of started playing in what I refer to as the creative bouncy room. That's when somebody has an idea and everybody starts playing with it and throwing it around the room. Kevin had initially said. He had said that he had always been fascinated with the idea of people in concentration camps, and that one line resonated with me because I'm a military brat, and I've always been had an interest in that area because of people I know who have been in that situation, and it just started from there. And we went through a couple of other publishers. One of them was absorbed by a larger company. One of them, and by the way, they're both great companies. They are absolutely wonderful companies. And it's been a long, troubled route on the film TV side. I started immediately trying to gain interest out there. And, you know, for film and television, it's a constant roller coaster, up and down. So we've had huge interest in this, back and forth. We were with one company where the president of the company was literally talking production designs at that moment, where location shooting. And then unfortunately, and I'm not kidding, so, you know, don't laugh at this because it was tragic, literally like a month later, he passed away. And that ended that. And Kevin and I were very impressed by
this. This is a deadly project. I mean, it's killing companies.
It's true.
I mean, it's not a joke, but we shouldn't be saying this.
So,
what if the vault's listening and then they feel fear for their own company security?
It will be their termination or their big, you know, flagship. And, you know, we did take it out to networks and we're still doing that. So it is still an active project. And I can say we can't name names, but it has gotten huge interest out there with big names. So we've been kind of taking meetings and chatting with, and we'll see where it goes.
That's really cool, though. We need some more interesting content on television right now. So that will be really cool.
Well, we were going to change it to like the Apprentice POW camp or something like that and see what we could do with that. Take on it,
yeah.
Or Survivor, Alien Prisoner of War Camp, if that goes, and more flexible, but we would kind of rather have it adapted with the story that we've already written.
Yeah.
We still have our Broadway musical notes for this, just in case.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things that's in the book, as they were putting, as I mentioned, we already had all the artwork done from the previous incarnation of this, and it was pretty much ready to go, but when the vault picked it up, they had an interesting idea to add some additional content to it, not just the usual sketches and development stuff that they often put at the end of a graphic novel. But they asked us if Steve and I would write an original novella in the same universe. And this was way during the early negotiations, and we just said, sure, we can come up with something like that. And then everything takes a long time to get contracts through and all this stuff. And then it was like last November, wasn't it, Steve, where they said, okay, it's time, we're putting it together, we need this novella. And we kind of rather quickly did, well, let's do Deacon's backstory. And Deacon, I'll let Steve talk about her in just a minute, but Deacon's one of our main characters, and we wanted her origin story. So we brainstormed that a little bit and kind of quickly did, it was like a 40-45-page story. It's a pretty significant story. And we love the whole backstory in this, and we thought, well, that would make a great prequel movie, too, so it rolls off. But why don't you tell them about who Deacon is, Steve?
Well, we have several characters in the Stalag X universe that have all come together at this particular event, but each one of them has a deep enough backstory to create their own story in itself. There's obviously Linda. There's Linda and Debbie together. There's Felix, and these names don't mean anything to you until you buy the book. the Deacon character, you know, keep in mind this is a concentration camp, which should not exist, by the way. That's one of the big keys here. The Krayl are actually winning this war against humanity. We are losing it. We are absolutely losing it. There's no reason for them to have a concentration camp because this is a blood war. Nobody takes prisoners. Humans don't take prisoners either. We just kill them on sight. And suddenly we discover that they have this concentration camp where they are experimenting on humans in very graphic ways, but it looks like they're searching for something because it seems like maybe they don't think they can win this war. And that, of course, becomes the core of what we're searching. But there's a mining colony on this planet that is occupied. You know, think of it much like an occupied town in occupied France during World War II. And those people are used for labor, and then there's a concentration camp where prisoners of war are experimented upon. Obviously, there's a very tight control over all the humans on this planet by the Krayl. But there's one human who just seems to walk among the Krayl with impunity. In fact, the Krayl seem to be a little afraid of this character, and it's this woman named Deacon. And Deacon's appearance is a surprise to our characters, certainly, because she can walk in and out of the camp at will. Her spacecraft is actually in the camp. It's disabled, but it's there. And what you find out is that she took advantage of the Krail caste system. Caste system meaning that they have a commander, then they have subordinates and subordinates and subordinates. And she had been watching the Krail for a while and basically killed the previous commandant in hand-to-hand combat. And because of that, she earned their respect, but not her freedom. She's not allowed to leave the planet. But she becomes central because she's a character that is not necessarily a nice person. Her background is as an assassin. That's what she does. But I find her to be extremely fascinating. And when we were talking about doing the novella, it was obvious that was the one we wanted to explore the most, you know. But we have, like, other characters that we've even thought about. Assuming this is successful, we might even do an anthology book about the backstories of each character.
Well, and one thing that we should mention is that the Krail, especially the warrior cast, they're huge, ugly, nasty monsters. I mean, think of the Gorn in Star Trek or the Predators or, you know, big, nasty monsters. So for this somewhat petite, very pretty woman to kick the butt and kill one of their commandants is a shocking thing. I mean, you don't expect this because it's not the sort of thing that it's like putting a person against a grizzly bear. You would never expect a human to beat that person. So that really shows how tough Deacon is and builds her mystery even more. So, and one of the things that I want to throw back into this is that we had kind of two concept artists. One was Igor Corday way, way back 15 years ago, who was one of my comic artists that I worked with in a bunch of Star Wars comics and Star Trek comics that I worked on. And we gave him the outline for Stalag X, and he designed some of the aliens and the different characters. And I don't even recall if we used a lot of those in the current version. But then we got another Spanish artist, Mike Rotera, who's from Barcelona, I believe. And he just brainstormed with us after he read the thing, and he developed all of the characters and all the spaceships. And he's got a very interesting, almost a retro style. It feels like a good, like, 1950s action science fiction adventure. That's the look and feel that I get out of it. But it's grittier and more graphic than anything you would have seen in the 50s.
He's a very, very detailed artist. When you open the pages, it just springs out at you. He's extremely detailed.
So when you guys were working on the novella, you said you didn't have a lot of time. Did you already have the basic concept before, or how did you get it ready in time? Because, I mean, that's a lot of work to do so quickly.
Oh, we're fast.
Yeah, we had, as I mentioned earlier, our research, we already had a lot of the backstories on our characters already. So we knew the basic thing. It was just the flow and structure of the particular story.
Well, and I'm a very fast writer. Steve's written for TV. He's a very fast writer. So we aren't sort of sitting around and waiting for the muse to whisper a metaphor in our ears. You got a job to do, and I kind of dropped other projects. I think I spent about a week on it to write the first draft after Steve and I were really brainstorming, and then he took, I don't know, 4 or 5 days to do his edit and rewrite a bunch of parts of it, and we went back and forth. So it didn't take a long time, but we certainly had enough time. It wasn't like we quickly rushed it out. But we're both working writers, and we're both very fairly fast at doing it, and that's just who we are. We've got all these stories ready to explode out of our heads, and so we better relieve the brain pressure and get it out.
I love that description that you're not waiting for the muse to whisper in your ear. I love that.
Well, I talk to some of my like literary writer friends, and they write one short story every 9 months, and I'm thinking, what do you do with all that time? I mean, really, there's after a couple of drafts, the story's about as good as it's going to get. You can rewrite it 12 more times, and it's not going to be noticeably better. I think it's a far better technique to write a decent story in the first place and then clean it up. So I've just always been a writer with lots of stories in my mind, and I spend a lot of hours writing, so I get lots of stuff out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Makes
and,
sense.
You know, television and film, it's especially television, the script master has to be fed every 6 days, so you learn to write very, very quickly. And right now, I think, you know, there's a style that, you know, Kevin and I have completely different styles and approaches to it because we come from different backgrounds. But on our core story level, we have very little disagreement. We kind of, you know, like I said, it's the creative bouncy room. You know, sometimes we'll get into detailed discussions. But when I am coming up with an initial idea, and, you know, Kevin, you can tell me if this is part of your process, or when I'm hearing input from somebody else, I'm actually writing the story in my head at that moment. It's not like I'm just putting together the details to write letter. My mind works. Everything's got to connect. So, you know, some people say when they're giving me input on my story, I look at them as if I'm not believing anything they're saying. But in fact, I have this blank look on my face because I'm actually crafting the story.
You're
as
in a different
they talk.
Universe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and another thing I should point out. Remember, I said before that Steve and I each have our very strong strengths. I'm not sure that sounds pretty, but we have our strong strengths. And I come from the prose world and the graphic novel world, and Steve comes from the film and TV world. And so when it comes to this novella, which is a prose novella, it was on my shoulders to write the first draft of it and get all the words down and then let Steve work with them. And what we haven't mentioned yet is that we also have the pilot script to turn this into a TV show or a film. And, of course, that's Steve's area of expertise. So Steve did most of the heavy lifting on doing the pilot script, and then I read it and made comments and worked on it. So we have our own separate territories that we're really good at, and then together we can kind of cover all the bases to get as much interest as we possibly can with Stalag X.
Yeah. And also, just as I mentioned of this, as with any good partnerships, I am learning by working with Kevin to move into his world. I've already started writing novels and writing short stories, some of them you can find online, to test out my wings there. Kevin is doing the same thing because eventually Kevin is not going to need me anymore. Kevin has a lot of his own material, which he's got out there and trying to get optioned, and he wants the ability to be able to write his screenplays.
And they'll probably need to be fixed a great deal, but I'll learn. Go ahead, Sherry.
When you guys are working together toward the screenplay or for the book and you're in your bouncy room, are you actually, you said you're thinking and stuff, but are you actually writing notes and typing, or are you both working on it separately and then coming together and bouncing more? How does that process work?
Well, we're mostly on the phone because I live in Colorado and he lives in the Southern California, so we do a lot of the phone conversations and brainstorming. I am a genuinely sucky note taker. I like to listen with my full attention and then hope I remember it. There are other people who take meticulous notes, and I have just never been able to do that. I maybe mistakenly rely on my ultra crystal clear memory. Doesn't always work, but I fool myself maybe that I think that. I don't know how Steve does it, but we talk on the phone, and he will often write a draft of something and send it to me, or we'll just sketch something out. But I don't even know what your process is, Steve. How do you take notes when we're doing conversations?
You know, some of our stuff, by the way, is through email, so it's somewhat easier that way because that actually is printed, or at least on the screen. So I do take the individual notes and the comments and the flow. But interestingly enough, when I give input, like if I get a draft from Kevin and I'm giving my overall notes, whether they're short or long or detailed or general, what I then do is when he takes it and starts working with it, I actually kind of forget the notes that I told him, because when he sends it back to me, I want to read it completely fresh because, you know, when Kevin trusts me, I trust Kevin. So if I give him some input and he tries it and it doesn't work, I at least know he's trying it. So I know, however, he'll understand what my concern was and try to address that in his own particular way. So when I read it, if I don't have any more speed bumps as I'm reading it, I really don't care whether he took the individual notes or not. I'm looking for the final product. And I do the same thing when we are discussing the story back and forth. I like more of the flow and the feel, and then I will jot down little specific things that I want to remember, but only because those specific things work seamlessly into the context of the story we're trying to tell.
And that's how it really works for other collaborations that I do, too. Because if you're working with a creative collaborator, it's kind of like a marriage. You're supposed to be trusting each other, and you're supposed to be there because you both want to be there, and there's a mutual benefit to being there. And, like, I have done a lot of books with Brian Herbert in the Dune universe, or thrillers with Doug Beeson. And we always have this understanding that it goes back and forth, but you're not supposed to go back and double-check your last version to see what the co-author changed. You're supposed to read it fresh and trust what the other person is doing. And if something really doesn't strike you right, you don't go back like a legal document and track changes and try to figure out what the difference is. You just go, well, does this work or does it not? And if it doesn't work, how do I fix it? And then you send it back to your co-author, and you keep going until you're both satisfied with what the end result is. And that's the best way to really get synergy going. Because if you, if Brian Herbert sends me a novel manuscript back and I mark all over it in red ink and send it back to him to show him all of the corrections that I made, he feels it feels like I'm the teacher and he's the student, or vice versa. You don't want that in a collaborative team. You want to be able to brainstorm, be able to add your own input, and just run with it. And that's how Steve and I worked on developing initially the comic scripts and just brainstorming the story, and we've developed so much backstory and all the characters. We're waiting to do the TV series plus the 10 spin-off series, because then we might catch up with what we've already got.
That's true.
It's funny because when we do our radio theater, Sherry's Playhouse, we do that. We do the same collaborative thing. I'll have an actor say, could I read do the words here to make it more comfortable for me? And I'm like, sure. And I always check with the playwright if it's not me. And I have not had one that says, no, it has to be pristine. It's like Shakespeare. And I've not had one person do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
especially in television, that happens a lot. And you, television especially is a collaborative medium where everybody has to work together. So I run into writers who it's like, you know, what's on the page is inviolate. You cannot change one tiny verb. And
no.
Others who feel, well, you know, the actors have to make it comfortable for them. But by the same token, the actors do not have leeway to completely change vast swaths of it to appeal to their own personal ego. And you know, the professionals don't do that.
Yeah.
And you can see in some movies where they're really comfortable, and that's when they really come alive. And there are other times when you watch them on screen, and you know that they're forcing themselves to say words that no human being would ever speak. And I won't point out, but there are some times in the Star Wars prequels, like Attack of the Clones, that Ewan McGregor, forgetting Anakin. I forgot the actor's name. Caden Christensen. That he's saying lines that you go, nobody would speak like that. That's not a line that anybody would say, but it was written properly. And the reason I bring that up is because today is the day that the Han Solo movie starts, and we're going to the first show in a couple of hours. And so that's why Star Wars was on my mind. Anyway, so I bring that up.
Yeah, and that's a big difference, by the way, between writing prose and writing screenplays. In prose, the dialogue is written different.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I tell people, they think I know a lot about grammar. And I'm like, no, I write television. Why would I have to know about grammar? I need to know about colloquialism, colloquial speaking. But when you're writing prose, there's a particular technique, and that is one area that I pay special attention to when I'm writing prose, and I advise all novelists who decide to write screenplays to start saying all your prose dialogue out loud. You'll begin to realize how stiff and unnatural it actually sounds when it's spoken.
Hark, yonder lies the castle of my fathers. Great fantasy dialogue there. So we don't want to.
I'm going to use that.
Yeah. Now, for me though, the way I write is with a digital recorder. I like to go out hiking and walk on the bike paths and stuff, and I dictate my writing. And so, when my characters speak dialogue, those are actually words coming out of at least one human's mouth. So I have good friends with one of the people that reads a lot of my audiobooks, and he'll tell me stories about some authors that write these sentences that are just simply impossible to speak because it looks great on the page, but when it comes out of your mouth in an audiobook, when you're typing, you don't necessarily notice that you just had five words in a row that started with the letter S. But when you speak them aloud, you certainly notice that. And I've had people tell me that my prose and my dialogue is a lot easier to put into audiobooks because it was originally spoken, so it came out sounding, I hope, non-stupid.
I think that's more interesting things because I've heard some audiobooks that are really rather stiff because they couldn't get their mouths around the prose.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. And I've also heard, television and film shows, as Kevin referenced, that you can tell somebody wrote it as in the margins when I give notes on scripts. One of the things I will say, this is too prosaic, or it's or OTN, which means it's on the nose. The dialogue is on the nose. It's got to be colloquial. You shouldn't just repeat the dialogue out loud. You have to do it in character so you can understand how it flows. But it really is defines mostly whether somebody can transplant themselves from one media to the other as far as film and novels are concerned. And by the way, I dictate mine as well. I just dictate it to my dog, and he types it up.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, man. I love you. I'm in love.
Well, one of the things I just last week I delivered a gigantic new epic fantasy novel called Spine of the Dragon. It was 800 pages long, and I've been working on it for a year, and I delivered it to the publisher. And this is a Game of Thrones-type big epic fantasy, and as you're writing all these characters and all their dialogue, it's a big fantasy novel, so you can't use things like, it ain't so, and in fact, you even try to avoid contractions, and you make it look like heavy, important fantasy dialogue. But I don't know the answer to this because I never paid close attention. In the TV show Game of Thrones, do they speak without contractions or do they speak more casually? I think they're a bit formal, but I never actually
watched it. They are more formal. The thing is, and Game of Thrones, using that as an example, the fact that you can't remember that shows how seamlessly they've incorporated it into the characters.
Good.
So they do use contractions, but they don't use it the way we do in modern. There's, you know, language, dialects, dialogue actually adds to the environment of a story. So that's a good example of a show that does it seamlessly. And I don't like to slam shows because, you know, who am I to speak
work on
them
certainly someday.
Popular shows. That's true, too. But there are several shows that my big criticism has been that the dialogue just drives me up the wall. The story construction may be great, but, man, I just don't buy any of the characters because of how they're having to speak.
Well, one of the things that Steve taught me, it's like this big obvious slap on your forehead that I never noticed before, and this is, I had probably published 70 novels before Steve said this, and I realized that you don't, when you're writing, you will often do dialogue and put the person's name in the dialogue. Isn't that right, Steve? Yes, it is, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
Sherry, we're doing... And when people really talk to each other, you almost never say the other person's name because you know darn well who you're talking to. And in script dialogue and in prose dialogue, when you type it, you very often... what do you think of this, Steve? Well, I don't know, Kevin. What are we going to do? Well, let me tell you, Steve. We'll think of this. Well, good, Kevin. I'm listening to it. Nobody really talks like that. But that's the way we write. That's the way a lot of scripts are. And I've seen things on, of course, ever since he alerted me to this, he's now ruined a whole bunch of my favorite shows because you watch this and you realize they're naming each other all the time when you're just face-to-face, and that's just one of those quick little writing lessons that I wish I had known many, many years ago.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. Especially in some of the like novels that go into becoming TV series, I don't know if it has to do with trying to keep to the author's text or what it is, but they do name each other a lot. I never really thought about that, but it's an interesting thing, and now I'm going to be more aware.
Mm-hmm. And you see it
I
a lot.
I think it's kind
of
a lazy thing.
And it's exactly what I was about to say. You see it a lot in scripts, and it's lazy writing. There are certain things that there are certain crimes I commit in my scripts, but I know I'm doing them, so I'm going to take them out before anybody reads them. I just want to keep the flow going. But I will take a script, and as a standard rule, I'll say anytime you have mentioned a person's name in dialogue, when we already know who the people are, and the people know who each other are, just do a search and replace. Search and replace it with nothing. Just take it out. My particular thing is I use what I call prepositional comments. You know, this is the time we should be going. The you know is totally irrelevant. But I do that as a natural flow of my own speech pattern when I'm writing. So I just know whenever I finish the script, I go right back through the entire script, and I start deleting those little pre-comments from my dialogue. You just have to be aware of it.
Now, an actor might put those in casually as he's delivering it because it sounds more natural that way. But writing it, unless you're getting paid by the word, don't put it in there.
You ain't getting paid by the word in teleplays, I can tell you.
It is funny because my brother and I were watching a documentary, and I as soon as the host said, you know, I said, oh, he's from California.
Well, see, you just gave an example of how phraseology and colloquialisms add to the content of the story and the feeling of the story. That is absolutely true.
Yeah. It's funny. I didn't even think about that, but we're going, oh, okay, that guy's from Florida, that guy's from New York, that guy's from California. That's what my brother and I do. We're weird.
Well, unfortunately, though, because of TV and because everybody watches the same, TV shows and news shows and things, we have genericized our language. Before everybody watched the same TV show, you had people with completely different phraseologies and things from the Midwest to the Northeast to the Southeast. But now because everybody's watching the same sort of standardized language, we at least have a common set of idioms that we're talking to, although you will notice certain localisms when I come from Wisconsin, so I go back home sometimes and I go, you really, nobody talks like that except in this particular area. And I noticed a phrase, because my wife will be happily correct me when I say stupid phrases and things. And one of the things I used to say all the time in the Midwest is let's take and go to the store. And let's take and cook some dinner. And I have no idea what take and adds to the sentence, but that's a way we used to talk. And when she pointed it out and I was trying to explain myself, I couldn't explain it because I didn't know what it meant. But that's just the way our natural thing was.
Let's do lunch used to be an exclusively New York and L.A. thing.
Yeah.
When you're young and you move someplace, like when I was 9 years old, I moved from California to Ohio. And I didn't know I had an accent. When I moved to Ohio, I was the alien. I was the oddball. And suddenly I found out, you have an accent in California, because all TV shows have this Californian kind of accent. So I never even realized I had an accent until I moved to another state.
Well, and we
and
always
you know,
used
back
to
in the days of the golden days of radio, the radio accent was basically Midwestern. And it was that very ponderous type of voice that spoke very articulately, but it represented Central America.
Yep.
And
Paul
now,
Harvey,
you know, we're
good
kind
day.
Of all over the place. That's right, good day.
Yeah. Well, and we used to insist that, well, people from Wisconsin didn't have an accent and other people did. And then I moved out to California and everybody made fun of my accent. And I'm like, well, but I'm talking the same way you guys are. Well, that's not what they heard. But because I was watching TV all the time, I thought the California accent was what everybody sounded like, and I thought that's what I sounded like. But I didn't realize I had this Midwestern twang that I worked very hard over the years to get rid of. I hope I don't still have a whole lot of it. But
you betcha. You've got it gone.
Ah, you
no
betcha.
Problem.
Yeah, I'm going to go up on the roof. Oh, yeah.
Really, what's really wacky, you betcha.
I
came back home to California. We lived in Ohio for 2 years. We lived in New Jersey for a year, and I came back home. People started asking me where I was from. And I'm like, here? I was Los Angeles? No, no, you have an accent, and it's a weird accent. We can't find out what, because I had absorbed the Ohio and New Jersey accents, so apparently I was a mess. I was California, New Jersey, and Ohio.
We don't often hear it. I mean, when I moved out to Los Angeles and I was working at a restaurant, my friends who were also waiters there, my Chicano friends there, immediately nailed that I had a slight Cubano accent in my Spanish. Well, it's because I'm from Florida. I'd learned Castilian Spanish, but all my friends were Cubano, and so when I came out, I didn't think anything about it, but it was like, no, man, you have an accent.
See, Sherry, we've gone far afield from prison camps and alien genocide wars.
We have. Well, the Creole also have accents. There, I brought us back.
Yes, there we go.
So I want to give you guys an opportunity to tell everybody where they can buy it and if you guys will be having appearances.
Well, you can go, Steve. Do you have any appearances?
Yes. I'm appearing right now. You just can't see me. I've had a very busy month as far as appearances are concerned. My next appearance actually would be in San Diego this weekend at the Mensa Convention, the regional Mensa Convention. I'm appearing there. I know one of these things is not like the other ones. Doing a discussion about basically how TV writers and prose writers and all writers manipulate human beings, because that's our superpower. That's what we do. As far as Stalag X is concerned, and I've got some other appearances I'll announce to us on my Facebook page. Just Google Stephen L. Sears. You'll see either a picture of me or my dog. Of course, then again, if you got here through the Facebook page, you already know where I am.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Stalag X is concerned, yeah, that is brick and mortar. You can obviously find it on Amazon and online retailers. I have recently engaged in the Stalag X hunt, which means every time I'm near a bookstore, I go seek it out just so I can see it on the shelves. And my first victory, I'll give a shout-out, was at Books A Million in Tallahassee, Florida. That's where I found the first one. Yeehaw! I was so happy.
And I actually just finished a bunch of appearances. I've got most of the next month off so I can get some writing done. I'm guest keynote speaker at this big financial technology conference in Minneapolis in the middle of June, and then I'm teaching at a Colorado university for about 3 weeks in July. So that kind of takes me off the book signing circuit, although if you come to a little tiny bookstore in Crested Butte, Colorado, you might be able to get some signed copies of my stuff. But then I've got a whole bunch in August. I'm going to be at the Michigan Comic Con. I'm going to be at the Tampa Bay Comic Con. I'm going to be at Dragon Con in Atlanta. So you'll be able to see me and pick up copies of Stalag X there or some other things. And I also want to drop a little plug, because on the day Stalag X was released, I also had another hardcover alternative history fantasy novel that came out called Uncharted, Lewis and Clark in Arcane America. So that's, I wrote it with Sarah Hoyt, and it's basically Lewis and Clark explore a magical America with dinosaurs and revenants and zombies and shapeshifters, so it's not quite the history you learn. So that's called Uncharted. It came out the same day as Stalag X, so I had sort of a busy promotional day then. And this is kind of hiking season, so like I said, I do my writing while I'm dictating, so I try to keep the appearances and travel down during the summer months, because that's when I do mountain climbing and hiking all day long and get my year's worth of writing done.
And I just real quickly to, I don't have stuff out there yet in the novel area, but people keep looking out for a novel I'm in the middle of writing called Tomboys, which is a lot of fun, and another one called Harry O'Fell, which is actually based on the original screenplay of myself, one of my scripts that I'm turning into that. Also, if you want to test out my prose, if you go to my website, StephenLSears.com, and the L is important, one word, StephenLSears.com. If you go to StephenSears.com, well, I advise you to do that right now, and it's quite different. It's not a porn site. It's safe for work, but it is rather amusing. But the StephenLSears.com will link you to my author's page, where you'll actually find some of my prose pieces, short stories, not too long. And by the way, to show you how this business is kind of very small as far as the writing community is concerned. Kevin doesn't even know this. I was at WhedonCon this last weekend, which are all things Joss and everything else, a wonderful charity convention. I was speaking there, and I was on a panel sitting next to these two gentlemen who are working on a television series right now. And I had my Starlog X book, and when we were done with the panel, they looked over and they said, Kevin J. Anderson. And I went, yeah, Kevin and I have known each other for a long time. This is our project. And they said, wow, we're trying to acquire the rights to one of his novels right now.
Well, they're not trying very hard. Well, how hard is that?
Actually, they are. You've already met with them.
Yeah, okay. So that is actually, is this the Clockwork Lives people?
Yes, it is. Very good.
Yeah. Well, this is a steampunk Canterbury Tales thing that I wrote with Neil Peart, the drummer from Rush. And yes, we do have paperwork going, and there we're very close to having something ready for development there. But yeah. So I have a lot of irons in the fire. I'm just waiting for the fire to heat up a little bit. So, but Stalag X, we probably didn't cover this enough, but we do have is it a shopping agreement, Steve? What is the technical term for it? We have a shopping agreement
with Shoreline Entertainment at this particular moment. That's to try to find placement and also financing, and we are also gaining interest outside of that from sources that Shoreline can connect us with, people that I know to connect us with, and then even better than the both of that is when very big names just kind of contact you out of the blue and say, by the way, are these rights available? We're just kind of curious.
Yeah.
So
yeah, somebody wrote
about
to my website contact forms. I mean, if we're not hard to find in these days of social media. If you're looking for somebody, you should be able to find them. So it's nice to get a surprise email from a well-known name saying, we like this. Can we possibly look into the rights? And, of course, Steve and I immediately says, well, yes, okay, you can look at it.
Absolutely.
But to do the flip side of that, though, is there's a great deal of interest, and interest will buy you just about as much as a breath of air will, and you got to wait for them to move forward. And if you weren't an optimist, you would never be in this business at all. So we keep our fingers crossed, and we keep pursuing every possible lead, and one day we're going to have the Stalag X Apprentice TV show or something like that.
Yes. Well, as paraphrasing a famous saying, Hollywood is where you can die of hope.
Yes.
Okay. On that happy note, I want to thank you both for coming on the show. I always enjoy you guys. This is the first time I had both of you together. So it was cool. Mm-hmm. I've had both of you separately, but I've never had you together on the show. So it's really, it was interesting. You can kind of see what the writer's room is on the telephone.
And it was a bit nerve-wracking as you were waiting for us.
Yes.
But we got it.
We're happy, and we're here, and we did it, and I'm very happy that you guys made it.
Excellent. Well, it was a great conversation. So we'll have to be on again.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool.
For the
cool.
debut of Thanks. The feature film or the premiere of the pilot.
Yeah. It's a date.
we'll do that. The red carpet, or maybe we just get the plaid carpet or something like that.
I was going to say the mauve carpet.
Yes, it'll work.
All right.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Sherry. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.